listening to the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. In this episode, we're talking about Sho Kanishi's book, Anarchist Modernity, Cooperatism and Japanese-Russian Intellectual Relations in Modern Japan. It's a really brilliant book. I thoroughly recommend it, and I hope that our conversation, if you haven't read it already, encourages you to do so. Before we begin, I'd like to say thank you to those of you who have bought a copy of our first ever pamphlet, a translation of Victor Garcia's contribution to a necessary biography of José Chena Torrent, which we talked about in the last episode. If you'd like a copy and you live in the UK, then the easiest way to get one is to send £3.35 via PayPal to abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com and just put your postal address in the comments. If you don't live in the UK, or you'd like more than one copy, or you haven't got PayPal and you'd like a copy, then please feel free to get in touch with us and we can sort something out. As I said, the best way to contact us, whether it's about the pamphlet or anything else to do with the podcast, is abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. And if you have already sent us money but you didn't send us your address, then please get in touch with us and let us know where we should send it to. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Danny, you suggested this book for the book club, and I'm very, very pleased that you did. What was it that made you want to talk about the book in the podcast?
I mean, I remember the book being talked about by other enthusiasts of anarchist history, and being told about it and thinking, well, yeah, that sounds really interesting. You know, it's something that Pascal, who's been on the show before, has talked about. I think Ollie as well talked about it to me at one point. And yeah, just thinking, yes, that sounds like a really interesting book, you know, it being on my to read list. And then my partner sent me a link to an interview with the author on a website called Asia Art Tours. It's a really long interview. It's about the length of like a sort of academic article or so. And it's like partly biographical about the author and about his interests and things. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. It's very, very far from being like a sort of typical academic profile, you know, that he provides about himself and his interests and things like that. So I was really keen to read it. And then as soon as I read the introduction, I just thought, you know, this is really exciting. It's presenting anarchist history in ways that like chimed with things that I've been thinking or like hadn't like properly put into words before, but also was like challenging things that I'd thought before as well. And you know, I think challenging some things that maybe we've even said together on the podcast as well. And so I was really keen to like see where that went and stuff. I don't know, like what were your impressions of it as you started reading it?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that you did suggest it, because I found it, you know, one of the most engaging books I've read in a while. I think I sent you a message that I kind of wish I'd read this book much earlier, you know, kind of when I was writing my PhD. I think it asks some really poignant, insightful questions of not only its subject matter, you know, which in which there are kind of like things that I would have taken away as being very interesting. It's at roughly the same time as my own work, and asking some similar questions. But like what you said there, like the bigger picture really about anarchist history, what do these big themes mean to people studying this, you know, topics such as this? So I think it has that great combination of being really fascinating in its subject matter, intellectual exchanges between Japan and Russia in the late 19th, early 20th century, not something I knew anything about really at all. So I found all of that stuff really engaging, but yet also being a piece of history that brings a lot to people who write and read history a lot as well, that has kind of resonances across all kinds of different things. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So it's an interpretation of Japanese anarchism at the turn of the 20th century. And I think if, like me, you don't know that much about Japanese anarchism, you have to do a little bit of like reading around, I think, to sort of fill in some of the gaps. But like you say, it's also like it's a transnational kind of interpretation of the subject matter of Japanese anarchism. The transnational element is through this like framework of Russo-Japanese relations, And the period covered by the book includes the period when Russia and Japan was at war. So that makes like these like relationships that are networked, political, intellectual, translational, and interpersonal all the more intriguing, and give particular like, sort of political resonance to these exchanges. And the first chapter talks about Lev Mechnikov, who was a Russian anarchist who had been an acquaintance of Bakunin and was a part of the populist movement, or the Narodniks, and was later a collaborator of Kropotkin's. I mean, one of the things that this really interesting chapter did for me was think that if there isn't already a transnational history of the Russian populist movement, then there really should be. So if anyone listening knows of one, then please like recommend it to us, because you think the populists turn up absolutely everywhere. You know, like if you're reading about like the Paris Commune, then it's like, you know, you read about like, these like, members of the populist movement who were there in Paris. Then like, you know, obviously in terms of like the relationship of like to Marx and then to the Russian Revolution, like the letters of Vera Zasulich, Narodnik to Marx, and like how that was challenging Marx's like frameworks and ways of thinking about the development of history and stuff, and then how that then like sort of like, subsequently provides a framework for thinking about the history of the Russian Revolution, and then like as well like Japanese anarchism. And I'm sure like there's different directions as well. It's just that I thought this, you know, it's so interesting. It begins by talking about Mechnikov, who arrived in Japan and was struck by what was going on. So this is like, it talks about Mechnikov's interpretation of the Isshin, which is the period in Japanese history, which is normally thought of in like a classic Western historiographical framework as the time when Japanese history fuses with, or Japanese, the development of Japanese society fuses with kind of Western modernity. You know, this like forced opening of Japanese markets and things like this at the end of the 19th century. And, you know, which is then like consummated by Japan's victory in the war with Russia. But Mechnikov's interpretation of what's going on in Japan is like totally different, and helps to shine a light on practices that Shokunishi characterizes as cooperatist anarchism. And I think that one of the things that we've been a bit critical of, and I'm sure if we talked about this on the podcast, we've definitely talked about it to each other, is the way in which sometimes historians like ascribe anarchism to practices as opposed to like movements. So effectively suggesting that like anarchism is something that's being done somewhere by people who didn't talk about themselves as anarchists and things like this. And we've been quite critical of this because, we find it a bit like dubious, you know, to like sort of claim people for anarchism that who didn't consider themselves to be anarchists. You know, it just didn't seem like it's necessarily, I don't know, like if ethical or true or whatever. But I think the case here that is made for like a kind of cooperatist anarchism is sort of borne out by the way in which there's a kind of an interaction, a kind of feedback loop between people who are anarchists or are close to anarchism, like Mechnikov, who then appreciate what's happening and then engage with what's happening and then like in turn influence it. And then, you know, this like the book makes the case that this cooperatist anarchism remains a kind of strain that persists even like as the movement becomes self-consciously anarchist and is like is influencing Russian anarchism and is in turn being influenced by it. So I think it's much more convincing, I think, than a lot of the books that sort of claim anarchism almost as this like kind of trans-historical practice that you can ascribe to all kinds of like movements. But then the classic case that we've talked about in the past is where anarchism like is claimed for Taoism, you know, and Taoism is presented as a kind of anarchist movement. And we've been, you know, quite reluctant to accept that point of view. But then here, the case becomes fairly compelling, doesn't it? That the translations of Lao Tzu into Russian, that Tolstoy's involvement, and then that subsequent influence on Kropotkin and things like that, all starts to make a kind of sense that there's nothing I'd read before that had suggested that possibility, and it's laid out in pretty compelling detail here.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'm really glad that you brought that up because I thought exactly the same point. It's been a kind of a go-to shorthand for that type of history that I find quite unconvincing often, you know, this sort of anarchistic impulse that sort of trickles through the centuries. Like I've never really bought it. And that example of saying, well, anarchism is a bit like Taoism, and so that, you know, there's echoes there. What this actually does, which is different, and again, which I found much more convincing, was showing how people were reading Taoism, and it's not what Shokunishi isn't doing, or like my understanding anyway, isn't saying Taoism is anarchism. It's saying it was picked up by anarchists who then explicitly sort of then taught it on, infused it with their own thoughts, politics and things, and it's more like a case of, yeah, historicizing rather than, like you said, like a trans historical sort of reasoning. And thinking about sort of things permeating and sort of trickling through, I think that's a really nice, it's a really great way for the book to start with Meshnikov. And you see it, you know, it's quite a long book and it's quite, there's quite a lot to take in. But, you know, sort of a couple of chapters in, you do start to see these kind of echoes and connections come through. So Meshnikov reappears several times, either, you know, in his students that are kind of maintaining that lineage of interest in Japan, whether it's Japanese activists who studied at the school that he was a big part of, creating a language and cultural exchange school in Tokyo, in Kropotkin, who drew a lot from Meshnikov, who was then very, you know, well-read in Japan, sort of around the turn of the century. And so it's that, so much was new to me about this book, you know, including Meshnikov, what his ideas were, what he thought. So to start at this relatively like unusual place for me at first, yeah, it took a while to kind of get going, but you start to see it sort of weave through, echo and repeat, you know, throughout the book, to the point that the final chapter is about this developed understanding of nature and a sort of cooperativist view of evolution, which does have like a lineage back to Meshnikov, like all the way back to Meshnikov. I think that the way it starts really, yeah, sort of challenges me in terms of how I, you know, what I think is good history, I guess, and the things that I find convincing or not. So I thought, yeah, I'm really pleased that you picked up on that as well.
I totally agree that, like, you know, at the beginning I was thinking, well, are these like just sort of quite disparate phenomena that are being like talked about as having some kind of like bearing on anarchism? Because, you know, he proceeds from talking about Metchnikov. I don't know if it's the next chapter, but there's the chapter on Japanese conversions to Tolstoyan religion. So Tolstoy's interpretation, or a radical interpretation of religion, which sort of strips Christianity back to its essence and reads it as a kind of like one among many approaches to kind of like a kind of like morality and ethics. You know, I'm not an expert on this. There is like a whole scholarly field, isn't there, of like Tolstoy's religious writings and beliefs, but also like the reading of that as anarchistic or anarchist. It's really interesting, like how Orthodox Christianity in Japan, or people like trained in Orthodox Christianity in Japan, like pick up on Tolstoy and have like these intense, like sort of conversions to him and like to his way of thinking, and like read this as like a kind of true Christianity. At the same time that Tolstoy is being anathematized by the Orthodox Church in Russia. It's all really interesting, but like it did make me, at the time as I was reading it, I was thinking, well, isn't this just something different? You know, like you have like this phenomenon of like religious Japanese people converting to Tolstoy's way of thinking, and then prior to that, you have like this phenomenon of Russian exiles being in Japan and there being like translations of each other's works and stuff like that. But you know, what's the connection? You know, is this just like drawing these different like contemporaneous phenomena together in quite a perhaps that, you know, it's not like necessarily convincing to present this, you know, as a whole, as anarchist, you know, as a sort of Japanese anarchism. But really, like, as you say, like the way it like continually weaves together, and especially like by the end, is like bringing these themes together. Like you start to see that, yeah, no, this is, it's a convincing case for a fairly widespread, cohesive, or at least like, if not cohesive worldview, then, you know, widely shared, like, ethic and approach to politics, history, ideas of social change and practices of mutual aid and so on. But yeah, I found really convincing. Although like the question of like how widespread it was something that did like keep occurring to me. And I think that there's something that maybe, you know, that case could have been made a bit more clearly. There's a point where Kanishi mentions that there's a dictionary of Japanese anarchists that mentions 6,000 Japanese anarchist intellectuals, which is a very high number. Obviously, it's massive. So that indicates that, you know, obviously there was a mass movement there. But in terms of, you know, how this particular sort of vision of cooperatist anarchism as being at the kind of heart of this broader anarchist movement in this specific time period, I don't know. I think that could have been clarified a bit for me. But I don't know. We could talk a bit more about that. I don't think it's like a serious weakness overall. That, you know, it's like, as you say, it's like it really is compelling, and the way it sort of threads things together and makes these connections that are still, connections still occurring as you get right to the end of the book is great. And it's actually really like enjoyable, like reading experience, isn't it, when these names turn up, you know, right at the end. You know, he's talking about Esperanto and stuff, and these people who've been translating Russian literature at the beginning, you know, and you find at the beginning of the book, then turn up as being like these pioneers of Japanese Esperantism as well. It's like, you know, it's great. I was like really pleased to see them pop back up, you know.
They're like old friends. Yeah. I think that question of the, you know, that was one of the things, again, that I thought I would like some sense here of scale, particularly early on. I don't know if it's like it's a deliberate sort of sidestep, and you get the feeling that there's kind of peaks and troughs, you know, in levels of support. And Kanishi does kind of directly sort of towards the end of the book talk about this, what's called this winter period, you know, following the execution of Kotoku, which I remember again from my work, that made the news, in like quite serious news in Spanish anarchist papers. Now perhaps it shouldn't be surprising, but it was kind of, you know, that was a name that I picked up at the time and just thought, wow, it is pretty incredible, you know, the reach of these networks and how they talk to each other. You know, now having read something like this, you know, perhaps I wouldn't have been surprised, like, because it was obviously such a thing. But yeah, it's kind of decline period, or sort of, you know, sheltering away from repression period is kind of mentioned. And I guess on the flip side, the real sort of peak, and what I think is the kind of pivotal chapter of the book and real kind of kickstart to this as a movement, is the non-war movement. I think is where you get a sense of the of something really kind of growing, you know, beyond these kind of intellectual exchanges. And that's where as well Kanishi, you know, brings in this concept of Hymen, or Hymen, I'm not totally sure how you pronounce it, to mean, you know, and I think this challenges what you said about a sort of a shared ethic and an approach, you know, like that is becoming clearer as you move through the book. Like a you know, so it's a Japanese word that has a very specific meaning, thinking about the people, but kind of beyond nationality. You know, it's distinct from the word for the kind of the nation's people. You know, it's sometimes translated as like commoners, but that, you know, as Kanishi kind of, well, yeah, quite convincingly says, it actually has a very specific meaning, which, you know, and it becomes the title of the major non-war newspaper and things like that. So I think if we're still cautious about ascribing, you know, anarchism to all of the things that Kanishi's describing here, maybe this idea of like a hymenism is perhaps a closer way, you know, or more kind of specific way of describing what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Like, yeah, I find the whole thing about hymen is really interesting as well. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I did start doing the YouTube thing where, you know, you ask for pronunciations of like some of the key words and stuff. But to be honest, I didn't get very far with it. Apologies to listeners for mispronunciations throughout. But there's this word, H-E-I-M-I-N, which, as Jim says, is like a word for people, but it's very specifically not a territorial understanding of people. It's not a class-based understanding of people either. There's a bit where he says it's all people, equal and interdependent, which is obviously a radical word, you know. It's a radical word to have at your disposal. And the way that it's used, deployed in this sense, as a sort of resource against war is really interesting, because this movement is not just anti-war, it's specifically non-war, which again like gives it a real power, because there's a bit, isn't there, where the people who are involved in this non-war movement are kind of asked, well, you know, shouldn't we disband it and like turn our attentions elsewhere now that the war, we've failed to prevent the war? And they say no, because this non-war movement is actually advancing a different understanding of progress, society, civilization, and so on. You know, it's not just about can we stop this war. It's about like a different, you know, it's about a revolutionary approach to society, basically. You think like how many anti-war movements have there been, you know, in the 20th century that have failed that sort of test, really, you know, that you're anti-war and then when the war's over or when the war's started or whatever, you know, the energy just runs out of the movement. But like this idea of like developing a kind of non-war movement that, you know, has as one of its like chief like elements an intensification of dialogue with the people that you're, you know, the members of the territory that your state is at war with. It's just, I mean, I found it like so inspiring, so beautiful, really. And yeah, this later on, he talks about how Hyman, this idea of Hyman, is later combined with Sekeshugi, which is worldism. So it's just, I suppose it's like Paul Gilroy and Achille Mbembe and like some like other like philosophers talk about a planetary humanism. I think it's like based on like maybe Fanon maybe uses it somewhere. And I thought that, you know, that it struck me as having a similar kind of meaning, like this planetary humanism as Hyman combined with like worldism. I think, you know, it's maybe trying to express a similar kind of thing. And I've thought before of like whether like planetary humanism is can be understood as anarchism, or is like, you know, is there a way of like reading planetary humanism in that way? And I think that, you know, Anarchist Modernity, this book, would provide a route into thinking through those kind of questions precisely by presenting this. Because another like interesting aspect of this, like the non-war movement, was how it then has a kind of gendered component as well, like how this like these like ideas about worldism and the people are in kind of inherently through their own like understanding the undermining of the kind of patriarchal logics deployed by the nation state at war as well, right? And how like the kind of the way in which like war operates as a kind of testing ground for masculinity, but also like, you know, the mothers of the nation and things like this, I think is was really interesting as well. And it was out of the non-war movement that this like Women's World magazine emerged as well, you know, the journal that he talks about, which was the journal that provided the first like Japanese translations of Mutual Aid as well. And, you know, it's one of those, that's one of those bits I thought where all these sorts of things are coming together, and like where the sort of resonances and sort of not just resonances with anarchism, but direct linkages with anarchism become like really clear.
You mentioned translations there as well, and I think that's another key sort of theme through the runs through the book. You know, the importance of language, of having people who speak both of these languages. I didn't really know anything about Esperanto either. I realized when reading that chapter that I had absolutely no idea. I thought I sort of got it. What appears to be a really big uptake for this kind of invented language that's kind of designed to chime with that ethic kind of that we've spoken about, this Hyman worldism, you know, a language that's supposed to operate in a kind of non-territorial, non-bordered way, that the way it's kind of interpreted by anarchists in Japan, at least, is not trying to erase existing languages, but rather to provide a sort of supplementary one, which will assist in this really strong endeavor, which starts, you know, as we've said, back in mid to late 19th century, of this kind of real appetite and enthusiasm for translating Russian works, Russian literature, Russian politics, Russian science. I just found all of that really, again, quite inspiring, you know, and again, it's not something I had any idea about. And I think, again, that's something that, at least by me, perhaps can can go overlooked, you know, the role of translators in not just providing a very functional way, or they're a useful kind of part of any movement is having people who can do it, but actually feeding into the political ethos of the movement, as well as it having translation and kind of multilingualism at its core, I thought was a really strong current.
And it's multi-directional as well, isn't it? So it's not just that, like, you know, Russian ideas are imported into Japan. Like, you can really see, like, how, like, this work of translation is on the one hand, it's like, it's not just like, translation isn't just the importing of foreign ideas. It's like a way of, like, making these other ideas or these other, like, concepts or words or whatever make sense in the context that you're in. Like, that's kind of like what translation is about. And so that involves, like, some kind of level of transformation. But, like, also just that kind of the intensity with which these ideas are being engaged with is also an invitation for a dialogue and for, like, you know, and leads to, like, these, like, really, really generative and interesting, like, shared projects over things like Lao Tzu, but also, you know, in relation to Tolstoy, in relation to Kropotkin, and the way that then feeds into the kind of Esperanto, where there's obviously, like, massive overlaps with the Spanish movement, and in fact, you know, the way into, like, the 1950s, you had, like, connections between Japanese and Spanish anarchists, you know, at least at the level of correspondence, and partly through, like, working on shared work on this Esperanto anarchist magazine called Sens Totano as well. But I think it's put really beautifully by Sho Kanishi. I just want to quote him here, where he talks about how the Esperanto movement's imagination of free, non-state associations of people around the world expressed an ideology of liberation from the territorial utopia of Western modernity founded on the modern civilized state, which I think is also, like, a useful way of, like, thinking about time and modernity, because this is obviously another key aspect of the book, and it's a key intervention that Kanishi's making. We talked earlier about how we're resistant to this idea of anarchism as, like, a transhistorical phenomenon, you know, like this, you know, the permanent struggle of, like, liberty against authority or something like this. And Kanishi isn't doing that here. He's, like, very much situating cooperatist anarchism, Japanese anarchism, within a specific historical conjuncture. And he's presenting it as modern as well. But it's not just modern in the sense that it's either primitive or modern. So we talked about this in the episode on Hobsbawm as well, didn't we? Where how, like, in a way, like, debates about especially Spanish anarchism, but I think European anarchism more broadly, have been hamstrung by this dichotomous, like, understanding of, like, politics, right? That something's either primitive or it's modern. You know, it belongs to one epoch or the other. And obviously what modernity meant is means something different at different times. And what anarchists were thinking about at the turn of the century, they were thinking about their ideas as being, like, modern. And by that, they didn't just mean as belonging to the current time, but also as being, like, ideas connected to the future. And I think that's something that's really interesting that Kanishi brings out. But they were very open to, like, the latest developments, whatever they might be, right? In science, in technology, and so on. But, you know, we look back and, you know, as historians, we think about modernity as having a sort of finished kind of product. You know, modernity for us seems like a completed kind of project. So if you claim anarchism for modernity, then you were suggesting that, like, well, it's part and parcel of that modern world, right? And that's, to an extent, that's true, right? And anarchism, when we look back and are critical of, like, the historical anarchist movement, we can see that, like, anarchism had parts of, you know, the aspects of modernity that were detrimental to anarchism as a movement of liberation, right? So it had, like, aspects of it that were sexist, racist, what have you. But it was more broadly, like, anarchism as a movement of liberation, as a movement towards a radical non-state socialism, is not part and parcel with modernity as the finished product that, you know, that tends towards greater centralization, that tends towards the perfection of the state, that tends towards, like, national integration and things like this. So what Kanishi does, which I think is really convincing, is to say that, well, anarchism is, like, presenting, like, one possible outcome of modernity. And it's not the outcome that won, but it was seen as possible at the time. In order to like get to that, in order to like appreciate that, we have to sort of problematize and historicize modernity as like a, as a specific, like, you know, as it's normally talked about, as being specific, temporally bounded, geographically bounded, Eurocentric and what have you. And, you know, in lots of ways, this is not like, that's obviously not new to like make that observation. But I think to actually explore the potentials of that in a work of history, I think, you know, to me, it was like really exciting anyway to read it. You know, so anarchism in Japan, and I think this definitely applies to Spanish anarchism and anarchism elsewhere as well, is one of several projects to realize modernity. He talks about like the need to redeem history and things like this, you know, that anarchists realize that the way that society was developing, you know, modern Western civilization with its racial hierarchies, its technologies of war and things like this, were not what they associated with progress, civilization, those kinds of ideas. And so we can like look at that and say, well, they're deploying these terms, civilization, progress, stuff like that. So they're part and parcel of modernity. Yes, that's true. But what they meant by civilization and progress had like a kind of ethical quality. And in the particular, you know, the cases that Kanishi is talking about, had this like understanding of progress and civilization as being cooperatist. And this again, like, you know, links it back to Kropotkin. I don't know how well I'm explaining these ideas, and perhaps the fact that, you know, I'm maybe not coming across as that coherent in the way I'm framing it, is just an indication of like how like sometimes these ideas just come at you like fizzing, and it just seems to be going in all these kinds of exciting different directions. But to me, I found that like really like convincing, that so there's a way of like seeing anarchism as modern, but as a project of modernity that is running counter to the dominant project of modern civilization, but which also understands itself to be more progressive, more ethical, more civilizational, you know. So it's not like renouncing that heritage of modernity, you know, those like sort of enlightenment terminology, but it's like it's investing them with its own kind of significance, and it's refusing the significance that it's been endowed with by states and authorities.
I couldn't agree more that this is, you know, this is obviously the key, you know, takeaway from this book, and where I think it has a lot to say about a lot of things. And I think, you know, this question of modernity, and you're right, you know, other people have, you know, sort of explored this, but I think to start with it so clearly in the introduction, and then to run it, you know, through all of these many different themes and situations and characters, I think it is that strength and what this book offers, you know, beyond its fascinating content. You know, I think it's that framing, and I like the quote that you gave, because I've also made a note of it, you know, this idea of Western modernity as an ideology and as a utopian ideology, not something that's like a kind of objective fixed, you know, thing, point in time, object. This is I think Kanishi calls it the utopian sedentary imagination of a Western modernity of nation states. And it is that kind of sedentary, that fixedness that is exactly what Kanishi's trying to show isn't what's going on in these dynamics and relationships, and invites you to think about all the other places and times where it also wouldn't, you know, where it would also be contingent, where the modernity was not like a done deal. You know, what sort of challenging that, or, you know, adding a vision of that modernity into this framework does is inherently radical to do that, you know, in a piece of work like this. I think, you know, rejecting that insidious tendency of, you know, both people at the time, but also of historians, to present this as if it was the only narrative, which, you know, I'm sure no historian would say that this is how they think and operate, but you do get this sense that this was the world, this is how the world was going, and this is, you know, this is what it means, and this is what modernity is. It's a bit of a, you know, I'm sure it's a bit of a cliche for podcasters on the left to bring up people like Mark Fisher, but like, you know, it's similar to that tendency that Fisher noticed about, you know, there is no alternative, And that's kind of how it feels often in depictions of modernity, almost like there was no alternative, you know, to this. A while ago when I was still lecturing, I was thinking of a course that I'd like to teach about, you know, this kind of era, really, and like radicalism around the world. And I thought a snappy title for it could have been Another World Was Possible. And I think that, yeah, there are chimes with that, well, very much so, and Kanishi expresses it probably much better than I would have done in that course. But I think I find that idea really fascinating, and not to see it as retrograde, to not conform with this, not to see it as inevitable failures, that things didn't necessarily work out that way. I think Kanishi does really well at pushing back on that and just kind of denying the terms of that debate, almost by presenting this history in the way he does.
Definitely in like the case of like Spanish anarchist movements, you know, it's very typical to read that they're, you know, the movement founded because of its failure to adapt to modernity, right? Or couldn't meet the challenge of modernity, as if like modernity is this like, you know, inert rock kind of thing that like, you know, you run aground against, as opposed to something that is like dynamic and shaped by social forces and things like that, of course, of which like anarchism was a part. You know, the problem with like the arguments against that is to then just like go overboard on like anarchism as a sort of contributor to modernity. So like almost like anarchism has won in a way. And I think that like this way of thinking of like anarchism as like, you know, as a different understanding of like of modernity and its possibilities, you know, that then like opens the question of like, well, you know, why didn't it win? Like, you know, it was defeated. You know, we can talk about it as, you know, we can talk about why that happened and stuff like that. I think it's much more, it chimes with like my reading of the history. You know, I find it convincing. And I like the way like Kanishi is really resistant, you know, he's prepared to go all the way along the line with it, you know, and doesn't make concessions. Whether to, you know, people like myself who like more like tend to be more interested in like or has understood anarchism historically to be a movement of like working class like liberation or like a movement of the working class and peasants, and whereas Kanishi is prepared to like even like assert for anarchism a kind of like non-class based approach, which you know, I would have like qualms with, but which certainly does chime with like some like approaches to anarchism that you come across by like, both today and historically. But also like when it comes to like nationhood and things like this, like the insistence on like what, well, one of the key aspects in which like cooperatist anarchism is offering and like the non-war movement is offering an alternative modernity is through its like resistance to territorial claims. And, you know, like translation, Esperanto has been like one way in which like that's that resistance is practiced. The way he's like, he's prepared to talk about that as being in contrast to the classic politics of decolonization as well. And, you know, how that meant that, you know, anarchism or this corporatist anarchism wouldn't just like map onto a classically kind of like anti-imperialist framework, because that was ordinarily, you know, it's a territorial claim, isn't it? It's like saying, you know, this land belongs to this people. And that's the corporatist anarchists are taking a radically different approach. You know, they're not thinking about land and people in that sense, right? They're actively sort of delinking them, you know, which I think is like really interesting. You know, you can take it or leave it, but like there's no sort of concessions here to like what might make the book like a sort of trendier or what have you. You know, it's you know, just I find that like really refreshing, you know, like and like thought-provoking. There's lots, I think, that like, you know, lots of like anarchists in, I suppose, mainstream anarchist traditions would have qualms with here, like, you know, the way it talks about class, the way it talks about religion, the insistence on interpersonal, individual kind of relationships, on compassion, conviviality, things like this. I mean, I found it like really interesting, really compelling, and ultimately, like, it's convincing that these were the ingredients of a movement that was broad-based, had a big lasting influence, and had like concrete impacts as well. You know, one of the particular ones that he makes a case for is like the radicalization of Russian soldiers through propagandizing in prisoners of war camps in Japan, which is like, you know, was obviously a tremendously brave and exciting internationalist gesture. And obviously the radicalization of Russian soldiery in the early 20th century is like, is almost like the key to understanding the whole of the 20th century.
We kind of moved on to sort of talking about, as well as the themes like Kanishi's approach and the, you know, the big argument there. Do you think that this is not just a history of anarchism, but an anarchist history? It's something that we've discussed in parts before. We discussed it with Zoe Baker a couple of weeks ago, what she thought of the term. I think her response was it's kind of Marxist history that takes anarchism seriously would be anarchist history. I think Kanishi's approach is slightly different there. What do you think?
I'd say it's totally different. I mean, I think he counterposes anarchism to Marxism a lot. I think he sees like the Marxism, you know, sometimes I think he kind of presents a bit of a straw man actually of Marxism as, you know, the kind of vulgar Marxism of you'd associate with sort of the second international, you know, like this kind of very teleological, stagist appreciation of history. But I think that, you know, obviously Marxism is, it's a history and a theory of the history of class struggle. And Kanishi is presenting his work as anarchist history and as not that, right? As not taking like class struggle as primordial, or even like particularly relevant, you know, like specific like class struggle is not something that is evoked. And I think almost like opportunities where it could happen are not taken, and not because of any sort of limitations of Kanishi as a historian, but because he's got this commitment and this framework, which is prioritize other points of view, basically. So he says that he's writing anarchist history, and he presents it in the introduction. What he says is the phrase anarchist history here does not mean simply a history about anarchists. Rather, it expresses a view of modern global history as simultaneously existing multiple imagined and lived ideas of progress or modernity's absent teleological and hierarchical ordering. Now, we've got a problem, I think, that like the book is talking about historical anarchism. So anarchism as it existed and as it was practiced at this time. And he's presenting an understanding of anarchism as a method of history, which doesn't really correspond to historical anarchism. You know, he's saying like, what I'm doing, like this method, this approach is anarchist. But I don't think it would be recognized as anarchist by like sort of historical anarchists. You know, I don't think they would have said, okay, yes, we agree that's an anarchist method. So it would be up to us or up to other anarchist historians to say, is that sufficient for a work of history to be anarchist? Personally, I'd suggest not, but I do think it's like an extremely exciting and generative potential framework for writing history. But I don't see why it's necessarily specifically anarchist, or why hierarchical ordering of modernities. There is a hierarchical ordering of modernities in the way that the anarchists, like that he's talking about, understand the question, because they are saying that their modernity, right, their understanding of modernity, is more ethical, more progressive, more civilizational even than the dominant one. You know, that comes across in the chapter on the history slide. And this idea that like, you know, anarchists are opposed to hierarchy to the point that they're opposed to a hierarchy of significance or of like morality or whatever is, I mean, to me is like self-evidently untrue when you look at like anarchist like practice. So I'm not sure about that. And also, I'm not sure either that like the way he associates anarchism with the rejection of class analysis. You know, I do think that the overlap, you know, like what Zoe was saying, the overlaps between anarchism and Marxism are there historically. You know, like anarchists, you know, often used to say that they were Marxist up until the point of the sort of political question. You know, it's not like the dispute with Marxists is not about an understanding of history, or not about an understanding of the economy. It's about an approach to politics, an approach to political action. You know, I say that and then I think, but okay, but do I really agree with that? Because certainly in this period, there was a kind of an approach to history among a lot of Marxists that was highly determinist, highly teleological, very quietist, and ran counter to what anarchists were trying to do. I kind of think that, like, all of those, like, sort of debatable points aside, I feel like on a deeper level, I want to, like, sort of understand this book as anarchist history. I feel like maybe he could have made the case differently for why it is anarchist history. I do kind of think that, like, as sort of like trying to suggest that there is a way of doing anarchist history that you could apply to, like, say, the history of medicine or whatever, something that's, you know, or something else that's, you know, not necessarily got anything to do with anarchism. But say, yeah, this is anarchist history. I think I'm dubious about that, because I'm dubious about that, like, kind of the necessary sort of systematizing and dogmatizing of what is such a heterodox tradition. I think it's always going to be, like, kind of dubious, you know, there's always going to be qualms with it. But I think in writing about the anarchist movement historically, I think there is a space for people doing that and people interested in that to develop a kind of methodology. And I think that Kanishi is really pointing towards something here that I think, you know, I wouldn't, like, express it in the way that he's doing, but I think, like, anarchist history as a history of anarchism that understands it as a possible outcome of, or a possible, one possible modernity, basically, is, I think, like, a really useful starting point for other future work about anarchism, basically.
I'm in two minds, kind of, myself, about whether I'm totally convinced by the term, or even by the desirability of, as you said, almost straitjacketing something that is just so inherently heterodox that, you know, that it, I understand why you might want to push back, say, on, like, a Marxist historiographical tendency trend, massively, you know, significant sort of intellectual, you know, well, some of my own doubts or problems with that come from trying to have a sort of rigidish approach and system and things. And I think that, you know, I think this, the study of anarchism or the study of history by anarchists, should be open to all kinds of different ways and approaches. Well, I think, and I think that, you know, you made this point as well, I'm really glad that this book has that kind of debate in it, that it's got, that it makes the argument that this is what I'm doing, like, you know, quite boldly, and sticks to it. Whether it's something could take away and replicate, not sure, because I'm not sure it totally stands up. But the fact that it got me and us thinking and talking about it in that way, in a way that's in a sophisticated and like plausible way, I think it is, again, one of the main strengths of it. And again, it hinges on this question of modernity, which is something that, you know, I'm gonna carry with me. I think, you know, as I read, you know, all kinds of different things. So I think it succeeded in that extent in adding another frame, I guess, in which to look at history, whether or not it's resolved, you know, that this is our, you know, the way or our way, maybe not, but I respect and enjoyed the effort to do so.
The effort that he invests in it is also exposes, like, the kind of complacency of a lot of other historical writing, basically. You read something that, like, has this, like, kind of intellectual commitment to it, and which just, like, so consistently exposes, like, shortcomings in other, in dominant models. You know, like, I think the point he makes about utopianism is, like, a really, like, neat way of doing that. You know, like, how he sort of talks about how utopianism is characterized as, like, unrealistic, but that just presupposes or assumes, like, the realism of the Western modern utopia that we live in the ruins of, you know. You know, I made a marginal note that we live in the utopia of a class with no imagination. I think I'd rather live in a cooperative anarchist utopia, even if, like, in practice it doesn't turn out to be realistic, you know. We have to live in one unrealistic project.
Thanks for listening. There's a link to the interview with Sho Kanishi, mentioned by Danny earlier in the podcast, within the notes to this show, if you're interested in reading more on this subject and this author. As Danny mentioned at the top of the show, if you're interested in placing an order for our pamphlet, Victor Garcia's José Chena Torrent, A Contribution to a Necessary Biography, you can get in touch via email abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. Or if you're a UK listener, after just a single pamphlet, you can send £3.35 via PayPal to the same email address. If you are placing a direct order in this way, please do put your address in the comments to your payment. You can get in touch with us via the same email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. And you can subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Dinocio, Gente de Miniaterra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Les Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a picture taken from the periodical Haimin Shimbun, the publication of the non-war movement in Japan during the Russo-Japanese War. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
Senhor secretário de Estado, faz favor de...